Our first speaker is Dr. Martin Kroos. Dr. Kroos has spent most of his life in Tennessee. He did his undergraduate work at the University of Notre Dame. He subsequently went to the University of Tennessee at Memphis for medical school, as well as his surgical residency. Thereafter, he did his surgical intensive care fellowship at the University of Miami. He then went back to Memphis, where he's really been ever since. He is currently the chief of the Division of Trauma and Critical Care. He is also program director for surgical critical care. He's held multiple leadership positions, both on the local and national level, including serving as the director of the American Board of Surgery in 2012. He's published extensively, mostly in the area of trauma. He has hundreds of peer-reviewed articles to his name, and therefore we're extremely fortunate to have Dr. Kroos with us today. His first talk today is on blunt cerebrovascular injuries. I apologize to you that there was a misprint in the program. It says it's cardiovascular injuries, but it is in truth on cerebrovascular injuries. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kroos.
Thank you, Dr. King, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It was the misprint's no big deal. I probably sent the wrong thing in since we have a hard time in Tennessee with this whole typewriter business. But for the next little bit, I want to talk to you about blunt cerebrovascular injuries and their impact on our patients. I have no conflicts. Yes, the place really is called the Elvis Presley Memorial Trauma Center. At the end of, maybe after tomorrow's last talk, I'll tell you how it got its name. But nonetheless, it really is the Elvis Presley Memorial Trauma Center. Well, one of the earliest descriptions of blunt cerebrovascular injury came in this reputable medical journal of Sports Illustrated. And I'm sure many of you probably remember about a little over 10 years ago, a young girl named Brittany Cecil was at a hockey game, and she got hit in the head with a puck. She did okay for a bit. She was knocked out, went to the hospital, they watched her, she had a little laceration, they sewed it up. She was completely with the program and then was just discharged. A couple days later, she developed a high fever, became comatose, was rushed back to the hospital and died shortly thereafter. At post, she was noted to have a blunt cerebrovascular injury. She had vertebral artery occlusion and a giant posterior fossa infarct, hence the fever and hence the herniation and death. They spoke with this guy at Georgetown who said that this was an incredibly rare thing. Well, not so much is this a rare thing. It occurs in anywhere from 1 to 3% of all patients admitted to the hospital following blunt trauma. Now, 1 to 3% doesn't really sound like very much, but if you're in a high-volume center, that's a lot of patients. Even if you're in a low-volume center, if you don't have a high index of suspicion, then we're going to miss an injury, and then a certain number of patients will unfortunately wind up like poor Ms. Cecil. Now, as you know, surgeons, we like to categorize everything and put everything in a nice, neat category so that that can help to dictate treatment. And Walt Biffle and the group from Colorado came up with a grading system for blunt cerebrovascular injuries. And a grade one is a very small injury with luminal irregularity. And you can see that right there. And it's easy to miss on this arteriogram, but nonetheless, that's what it looks like. A grade two is a little bit easier to see. It involves greater than a quarter of the vessel, but it's a distinct dissection. Grade three is a pseudoaneurysm. Again, you don't really have to go to radiology school to see that this is not normal. And the same with complete occlusion. It's pretty easy to tell when the vessel's occluded, right? You're looking for something, whoop, it's not there. And then finally, transection or extravasation or an AV fistula. Typically, this occurs with a carotid cavernous fistula. Otherwise, a completely transected carotid is typically a pathologic diagnosis. So there's a number of issues with blunt cerebrovascular injuries. First is, how do we screen for it? Is CTA good enough? CT angiography? How do we if we screen, then how do we establish a definitive diagnosis? Because the definitive diagnosis then is going to require management. And the management is either operative or non-operative, right? I mean, every management of everything fits into one of those two categories. So not particularly difficult. But do we anticoagulate these patients now with the advent of stenting? You know, I don't know how it is here, but at least in Memphis, the presence of heart is an indication for a cardiac stent. I'm sorry, and a third-party payer. So is that beneficial in these particular patients? Because now you know, it's one thing to put a stent in if you're, you know, on up in the age spectrum, but now we're talking about patients with blunt cerebral vascular injuries who are 18, 19, 20 years old, and are they going to live the next 60 or 70 years with this this wire thing in their neck? Nobody really knows the answer to that. But nonetheless, let's talk just a bit about screening, first of all, because screening is pretty important, right? You want to catch all these patients early on the front end so that you can intervene prior to their stroke, which is the natural history of untreated occluded carotids in these particular patients. Angiography is really the gold standard, right? It's pretty unequivocal. Shoot an arteriogram, there's an abnormality, there's not an abnormality. There's an abnormality, we treat it, we address it. Otherwise, we don't. The problem is it's pretty invasive, right? Pretty invasive and fairly resource intensive, even for very busy trauma centers with an active interventional radiology department. It's pretty busy. CT angiography is really pretty simple because, again, following significant blunt trauma, presence of body is an indication for CT scans, right? Because we scan everybody. I don't know how it is here, but I can tell you in Memphis, we scan them. And I'll show you some of that data a little bit later. But CT angiography, obviously readily available, but it really has unproven reliability. And if you look at the literature, everybody sort of touts CT angiography, but it's not really based on very good data on the front end. But everybody wants it to work because it's so easy to do. Okay? Keep that in mind. Some early data came out of Dallas and Virginia had pretty decent sensitivities. Nobody's been able to really reproduce this 98% sensitivity. The problem is not everybody that had a CT angiogram also had a confirmatory digital subtraction angiogram. So we don't really know whether or not there was an injury or whether it wasn't. Same with Malhotra's study that was done. But then subsequent data has demonstrated not so good sensitivity. And if the sensitivity is really that bad, do we want to really risk missing a stroke in an otherwise young and healthy patient? So it's a problem using CTA. Now, there's standard physical findings that are used for screening criteria. Description of these came out of primarily Memphis and Denver through the years, but it basically includes smashed face, skull-base fracture, cervical spine fracture, especially to look for vertebral artery injuries as they go through the foramen, a seatbelt mark indicating a blunt injury to the neck, if a patient has Horner syndrome, and most importantly, an unexplained neurologic deficit or a deficit that is not consistent with the findings on head CT. The problem with this traditional screening criteria is we still miss 20% of the injuries, right? This is good for 80%. You'll pick up 80% of carotid injuries and vertebral artery injuries if you use these screening criteria. But for the 20%, again, that's a problem. So we looked at that. We tried to look at that at our institution and try to determine, is CTA decent, right? So all patients who were screened for blunt cerebrovascular injury, and the way we screen patients is if they had blunt trauma and were going to get a head CT, then they also got a CT angiogram of their neck. That's how we screen patients. So if anyone's injured enough to get their head scanned, they all get a CTA of their neck. Over a little over a 2-year period, all these patients had digital subtraction angiography after their CT angiogram. That's also how we did things in Memphis, is that our screening test really was digital subtraction angiography. So it was both screening and diagnostic. We thought we were pretty big shots because we had just gotten a new 32-slice CT scanner. Little did we find out that that's really old news, but we were pretty excited about it at the time. But nonetheless, so all patients had the CTA during their initial evaluation, and then, of course, we reviewed all the charts and so forth. Over that period of time, there were 28,000 patients that were evaluated. 750 were screened with angiography. The interventional radiologists loved this, sort of, because many of these were done in the middle of the night. That part they didn't love quite so much. Frankly. So of the 750 that were screened, there were 117 patients who had 143 injuries, which works out to about 16% of those that were screened. Most of these were carotid injuries. If you look at the traditional criteria and break it down to those that had injuries based on these standard indication, again, this accounts for about 80% of those with injuries. But then if you add in an abnormal CTA as a screening test, and either an abnormal CTA in conjunction with something else or an abnormal CTA only, that bumped up the sensitivity of this screening test so that now we are able to really identify almost all the patients that had injuries. So if we added the value of using a CTA as a screening test, not diagnostic, but a screening test, we were able to find an additional 23 patients that had injuries. And most of these were blunt carotid injuries. Wound up being 16 again. So if you remember, we were missing 20%, right? So we found 16%. So now we're only missing 4%. Well, that's a pretty good screening test if you can capture 96% of the patients that have that particular injury or disease. So based on this data, we thought that the role of CTA should be that you obtain one on anybody that you're going to scan their head and then obtain an arteriogram for the traditional screening criteria and if they had an abnormal CTA. So that's what we determined based on our 32-slice scanner, that abnormal CTA is a screening criterion, but not the definitive screening test. Big difference, okay? We presented that, and of course, people threw tomatoes at us because they didn't want that to be the case, right? Because CTA is easy. It's easy to do. And there's a bunch of problems with using digital subtraction angiography as the screening test, right? It's resource intensive, as we mentioned earlier. It's pretty invasive. I don't know if I mentioned that it's resource intensive. And it has its own set of inherent complications, not the least of which is it can cause a stroke. I mean, they don't do it on purpose, but you can get a stroke from a carotid arteriogram. And finally, I'm not sure if I mentioned this or not, but it's resource intensive. And very difficult to do in a high-volume center 24/7. So that being said, we had a bunch of bake sales and car washes and the like, and we went out and we bought a new scanner. So we repeated the study with a new 64-slice CT scanner. This was just presented at the AAST 2 years ago. Again, all patients had CTA and angiography, okay, using the 64-slice scanner, and basically looked at the same sorts of things. Similar distribution of injuries, with most of them being carotid injuries. And this is broken down by the grade. And you can see that 40% of these were grade 1 injuries that we can see. And not very many of them had really bad injuries. But that's good. Because then patients have a decent chance of getting better. If you look at the number of vessels, right, we looked at a little over 600 patients, so each of them have 4 vessels. And this is broken down. There were 196 overall that had positive CTAs and 52 that had false negative CTAs. Well, those are really the problem, the false negative CTAs, right, because those are the ones that we're liable to miss. So if you do the overall sensitivity for that, for sensitivity for using CTA is only 68% in our hands. Well, that doesn't really sound all that good when you think about it. 68%, that's not really very good. It is pretty specific, so a negative test is helpful, but not completely, right? But then if you break it down by patient, if you look at results per patient, the sensitivity overall improves with less false positives or fewer false negatives, which is really the problem. And the overall sensitivity bumps up to almost 85%. Okay, well, how can that be? If you do a CTA on a patient and it shows an injury and the patient gets an arteriogram and it shows an injury to the same vessel, then obviously that sensitivity for both CTA and DSA, if you look at it by vessel or if you look at it by patient, is 100%, right? Because it picked that up. On the other hand, patient two, let's say the CTA gives a false negative for the right carotid, but a true positive on the left carotid, and angiography demonstrates that they've got bilateral injuries. So CTA found one of the two, so it's 50% if you look at it by vessel, but by patient, because that patient had an abnormal test, right, that's 100%. And then the same thing, you can break it down to even different permutations, but nonetheless, this is how this illustrates how the sensitivity by vessel can be very different from sensitivity by patient, okay? So we then looked at, if you break it down by vessel, of the 52 false negative CTAs, the majority of these all occurred in patients with grade 1 injuries. If you look at it by patient, again, the majority were grade 1s of carotid injuries. Not quite as much, but there were only 8 vertebral injured patients anyway. Now, all these patients get a follow-up scan or a follow-up study after a week. They all got follow-up arteriograms so that we can see that in patients with grade 1 injuries, the overwhelming majority of them improved and are better in a week. Now, does that mean that it was an overcall on the front end? Maybe. But there was clearly an abnormality. And again, these are all diagnosed by digital subtraction angiography. So it's possible it's an overcall on the front end, but we think not because we did this. So therefore, it has to be right because we're the ones that did it. And the same with verts, although they don't improve quite as much as the carotids. But it's important to note that the majority of the carotids were grade ones, and they're all better in a week. Now, if you look at the data that Biffle presented, if you look at stroke rates by injury grade, as one would expect with increasing grade of injury, stroke rates go up for both carotid injuries and vertebral injuries. Again, not particularly surprising. So if you take the data that we presented and calculate the theoretic risk of stroke, and I'm not going to go through all the math because nobody told me there was going to be math involved in this, but if you jump through all the hoops and the various permutations, you wind up, if you use CTA as the screening test, not the criterion, but as the test, we're going to miss 2 patients over the study period. Well, that's pretty good, unless you happen to be one of those 2 patients, but that's really pretty good. Well, let's look at complications from the procedure itself. This was a patient who had a stent placed who unfortunately went into spasm and developed a stroke after a DSA. So that's just an example of what can happen. But if you do the calculations based on the serious complications, it winds up being a wash. So there's no difference between the complication rate of angiography and the number of theoretic missed injuries from using CTA as a screening test. So is a 64-slice CT scanner better? We think it is because it did significantly improve overall sensitivity, even though it's not great, but it's better. And most of these injuries are grade ones and they heal. And again, it's a pretty specific injury, if not specific. Now, do we even need to screen for it? Yeah, because it's pretty cost-effective to screen patients, and this is not just our opinion, others, because if you miss a patient and they have a stroke, the lifetime cost of a stroke is pretty expensive. They went through a fairly intense series of calculations in this particular study, and they determined that if the sensitivity is less than 93% or specificity is less than 81%, then angiography is the most effective CT test. Well, our CTA specificity was 91%, so at least if you use their argument, CTA is probably the way to go. Now, screening for this particular test is really kind of, it's a moot point if you don't have effective therapy for stroke prevention. For patients who do develop stroke, there's obvious morbidity and there's significant mortality that's associated with this. Why? It's all because of the circle of Willis, right? Everybody remembers the circle of Willis. Only 20% of humans have an intact circle of Willis, and usually what people are missing are the posterior communicating arteries, either one or both. Rats, on the other hand, have 100% intact circle of Willis, so that's why a lot of rat studies, you know, you can ligate their carotids, both of them, and you know they go on about their happy little business of doing whatever it is that rats do, but humans, not quite so much. Only normal anatomy in about 20%. So that's why, even with a single vessel, you can wind up with a young patient, especially, who develops a stroke. Well, anticoagulation therapy, the primary goal, of course, is to prevent propagation of clot and then subsequent stroke. Obvious contraindications to anticoagulation or antiplatelet therapy are ongoing hemorrhage. Again, you don't really have to work for NASA to figure that part out. And relative contraindications are people with mass lesions in their head from big cerebral contusions or subdurals or what have you. And I say relative because we've anticoagulated these patients. You have to do it pretty carefully and under a very close watch and have 27 people looking at them every day, but it can be done. We published this a long time ago, late 90s, where we stumbled across this the importance of using heparin in these particular patients. And we didn't completely anticoagulate them, get their PTTs out to 80 or so. We just get their PTTs in the mid-40s, between 40 and 60. Ideally, we shoot for 45 to 50 is where we want their PTTs. And we found that the use of heparin was independently associated with improvement and survival in these particular patients. The other thing that we sort of stumbled upon is we had 15 patients who had bilateral carotid injuries. All of them got started on heparin, and the asymptomatic side remained asymptomatic. Well, again, that's only 15 patients, but it's intriguing at least. It's not just us that tout anticoagulation, the group from Denver. Really, the groups from Memphis and Denver are the ones that have published the most on this particular topic through the years. They also found that if you treat patients, they have a very low risk of stroke. If you don't treat them, they have a very high risk of stroke. And does the treatment matter? This is a group from Maryland and Baltimore that treatment does reduce the risk of infarction following blunt cerebrovascular injury. Again, not particularly surprising. If you can intervene, then do it. Now, do we use heparin? Do we use anticoagulation or some of the newer antiplatelet drugs? You know, they may have therapeutic equivalency, but the problem is they're very difficult at best to reverse, right? So they've got their own associated risks, and I wish everybody could be as happy as these people are when they come in with their blunt cerebrovascular injury and they happen to be on one of these drugs, and they also have a small subdural. But then that small subdural winds up being a ginormous one, and they herniate and have a bad problem. So these drugs, while they're very good at what they do, they're almost too good at what they do. In fact, just before I came over here, I had the TV on, and there was some class action, you know, one of those lawyers that get on and they say, oh, you know, if you've stubbed your toe, then call this number and we'll sue the furniture manufacturer for having a leg on that table so that you stubbed your toe on it. Well, now they're going after these people for having bleeding complications. Well, I guess. It's pretty easy to figure out what happens in patients with dissections, right? The dissections typically get better over time. The problem is that follow-up, and this is six-month follow-up data, a third of these patients have pseudoaneurysms, and they don't get better, right? Pseudoaneurysm stays. So then what do we do about that? And this is not just us that stumbled upon this. A group from Denver also, a third of their patients had pseudoaneurysms as well. So again, this was the original arteriogram, and then this is one that occurs at a later date. It's pretty easy to see how this has devolved into that. That's obvious pseudoaneurysm, and then this is it treated with a coiling of the aneurysm and a stent. So we looked at this and we thought, okay, maybe we should be stenting all these people, right? Maybe we should stent them all. There was some early data that came out of Denver that said if you stent these people, they're all going to have a stroke. But what they were doing, they were stenting them acutely, like within the first couple of days after injury, and they found that, yeah, all those people did have strokes. So they said, oh, stenting is bad. What we did in this particular study is we didn't stent them until at minimum a week out from their injury to give everything sort of a chance to settle down. The patient goes from their hypercoagulable state following trauma to a little bit less. And so that's what we did. So for lower grade injuries, we get repeat angiogram, and if it wasn't healed, they had endovascular treatment. If they were occluded, they had aspirin only, and then if they had a fistula, then they got a stent. We looked at 220 patients that had injuries. That was the breakdown. A bunch of these patients had bilateral injuries. That's why the numbers don't quite add up. So of these 222 patients, 22 had a stroke prior to their diagnosis. Again, that's sort of a societal problem, and not much we could do about that. This was the breakdown of the 200 patients that were asymptomatic at the time of diagnosis. Of the 74 carotid, 50 of those patients had endovascular treatment, 22 were treated with anticoagulation. The majority of the patients with vertebral artery injuries were treated with aspirin, and less than a third of those patients had endovascular treatment. We had 85% follow-up, which is pretty remarkable and also really goes to the resilience of the particular resident that was involved in this particular study. She was like a pit bull in trying to go after these patients, and she was very successful. Well, it was successful 85% of the time. We identified 6 patients who had strokes and 5 patients that were potential strokes, but these potential strokes occurred in patients who also had closed head injuries as well, so it was difficult to tell what it came from. But to err on the side of caution, we call them strokes. So overall, there was a 17% mortality if you include the outpatient. Then if we look at the stroke rate based on the endovascular therapy versus medical therapy, it's all basically the same. So that this particular protocol of waiting and loading the patients with aspirin and Plavix prior to placement of the stent is actually pretty successful and puts our overall stroke rate and mortality rate on par, really better than a lot of the data that's been published. So our current algorithm for blunt cerebrovascular injury is if patients undergoing a head CT, they get a CT angiogram. If it's negative, then we go on about their business. If it's either positive or if they have a negative CTA with an unexplained neurologic exam, all those patients undergo 4-vessel arteriogram. We go ahead and we start heparin. We do not bolus the patient, but we start heparin at a fairly low dose, again, shooting for a PTT of 45 or so. And this is in the interim between their CTA and their arteriogram. And we'll arteriogram these patients in the middle of the night. If the arteriogram is negative, we stop their heparin and go on about our business. If it shows a dissection or a pseudoaneurysm, then we continue the heparin and we really push our consulting colleagues, such as predominantly orthopedics, to go ahead and get the fractures fixed so in that first week so that we can go ahead and have definitive therapy. And then the patients, because if the patient winds up needing a stent, then they're going to be on antiplatelet drugs, right? And to me, it's easier to operate on heparin than it is on antiplatelet drugs. Sometimes they don't see it that way, and I've never quite understood that. I think mainly it's because the orthopods don't particularly believe in this thing called hemostasis. I'm kidding if there's any I'm really not kidding. No. We actually get along very well with our orthopedic colleagues. So after a week, we repeat the study. If it's better, then they get no stent. If it's not better, then they may very well get a stent. They're treated with aspirin and Plavix. And then we restudy them in about 6 months. Typically, they'll then be off their aspirin and Plavix at that period of time. So in summary, you've got to have a high index of suspicion for these patients. Vertebral artery injuries really aren't rare, and they can cause significant morbidity and mortality. CTA still lacks some sensitivity, but it's good, has good specificity, has a good negative predictive value. We think that the 64-slice scanner can replace DSA as a screening test, and then antithrombotic therapy with selective stent placement is probably the way to go in these particular patients. again, just using CTA alone still sort of makes me a little bit nervous. In a way, it's we're still trying to fit all square pegs into a round hole, and that makes me a little bit nervous, but we just have to keep a very close eye on it. This is our place. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be in here.